I'd also like to talk about these people who were once here and who told these stories in times past and what they were like, because until we know a little bit about their life, their stories may seem kind of hollow to us. There was two different kinds of cultures in this part of the Northwest, depending on whether you were along the coast or whether you were here in the interior of the Northwest. Along the coast, you had a bunch of people that lived in very similar types of housing, wore certain types of clothes, ate certain types of food, and just kind of like to paint a little picture. Maybe we could make believe that we've gone to a village along the coast, along the beach. Maybe, I don't know, someplace near Bellingham or wherever. And it's in the early times before they had any trade goods or any of that good stuff that we depend on all the time. They were primitive, in other words. So what was their life like? What kind of a house did they live in? Does anyone know?
Longhouse.
What was it made of?
Cedar,
that's right. And they were built a little bit like some of our rustic barns are today. They use a wooden framework. Usually they use small trees and arrange them kind of like when we build barns, usually a gable roof. In other words, kind of pitched like a triangle. But they didn't have any nails. So what did they use instead of nails? They usually lashed the parts together. And since they didn't have sawmills, instead of sawing the planks out of the cedar trees, they would split them. And some people still do that today, making what they call shakes. Some of these planks were very long. And they didn't have chainsaws either in those days. They didn't even have axes, except very primitive stone axes. So how do you suppose they cut a tree down in those days?
Burned it.
That's right, they burn through. They would start a fire burning the trunk of the tree, and then when it burns through a little ways, they take their stone axe and chop away at that soft stuff, and they'd start another fire and keep on going until they went all the way through. So it's amazing that they were able to do this, but they did. And they lived in these longhouses all winter long, and in the summertime, sometimes they would build some more temporary shelters, summer shelters, further up the streams when they went hunting and berry picking and gathering, trying to find other things to eat. So that's just a little bit of their housing. What about their clothes? What did those people wear back in those days on the coast? Anybody know?
Cedar.
Cedar, yes. Cedar was like their staff of life, just like wheat is ours. I tried to duplicate this process myself. I soaked this piece of cedar bark in water overnight, and then I beat it with a rock, and it's very crude looking, but you can see the stuff is fibrous, so I'll pass it around. They actually wove cloth out of that stuff. Now, why would anybody want to dress in bark clothes? It sounds like somebody who's trying to prove just how much you can suffer or something like that. Some sort of an aesthetic who's trying to suffer. Why would anyone want to wear clothes made out of bark? Anybody know?
Is it water tension? Protection and waterproof?
Yes, it actually is like wool. It doesn't necessarily shed all the water, but it retains the warmth despite the soggy state of things. And in western Washington along the coast, maybe you that live there, it rains almost constantly all winter long. It doesn't rain too much in the summer, but in the winter, it's pretty long. It gets mighty wet. They needed protection. The women would wear skirts made of this stuff, the cedar bark. The men would wear leggings. They wore capes made of the cedar bark. They even wore hats shaped almost like a Chinese coolie hat, kind of cone-shaped, you know, the cedar bark. And that kept them relatively comfortable in the wintertime. What about their food? What did they eat?
Cedar bark.
As a matter of fact, when things were really rough and there was nothing else to eat, they could actually eat the inner bark and the cedar. So it was kind of like a complete staff of life. You could eat it, you could use it for clothes, and you could live inside of it. You could burn it for fuel, and you know, you could survive on it. But they didn't eat too much of the cedar.
Did they worship personification of the Great Spirit by
most? Oh, yes. As a matter of fact, when they finally got some more sophisticated tools, they learned from the natives further up the coast, the Indians that now live in what's Alaska, the art of carving totem poles, which is, you know, the embodiment of the spirit world on this earth. And, of course, those are made of cedar, too. So cedar had a very central role in their lives. But for food, they usually ate other things, not the cedar.
Fish,
yes, all kinds of seafood. And they would also go into the mountains to hunt Probably to get some game.
And berries.
Mountain goat was one of their favorites, as we'll soon learn. Bears, deer, and they'd also pick a lot of berries in the summertime. Women would eat, you know, people would eat as many as they could, and then the rest they would dry for winter.
They're great.
So that's a little kind of a nugget or a little short look at what the Coast Indians were like. But there was a totally different culture on the other side of the mountains, on the dry side of the mountains, like around here. What were those Indians like back in the old days?
Nomadic.
They were nomadic because food was a little further apart. It wasn't so easy to come across. They had to work harder to get it. And what kind of food did they get when they finally did get some?
Game animals,
yes. They did a lot of hunting. They looked for deer. They looked for just about anything that had four legs or sometimes something that flew. But there were certain things that were very important in their diet, even more important than deer.
Is it buffalo?
Well, buffalo became important when they got the horse.
Okay.
But in the old times, the horse has only been here about the last 150 years of Native American history in the Northwest, because it had to come all the way up from New Spain, all the way from the south, where the Spaniards kind of didn't keep real close track on their horses. Some of them got loose, and eventually they bred. They kind of got semi-wild, and then gradually they got passed along across North America, until by probably the late 1700s, you could find a few horses around here. So yes, in very late years, some of the tribes would actually hop on a horse and go all the way to Montana to hunt buffalo, because there wasn't any buffalo here. Buffalo were not found this far west. The grass wasn't suitable for buffalo to eat, so they just didn't live here. They didn't really live much west of the Rocky Mountains. They're mostly east of the Rockies. So that was a special treat when you got some buffalo, when it was carried.
Roots?
Yes. One root in particular, the Camas root, which is a member of the lily family. And it was a fleshy, kind of starchy root that was dug in the springtime. That's when the flowers bloomed, so they could tell which one was a Camas and which one was a death Camas that they didn't want to dig. It had a blue flower. And there's still some places today where they grow in profusion. And they would go out with a digging, mostly the women did this, they'd go out with a digging stick, they'd dig up a hole, then these would be roasted, and once they were roasted, they'd keep for a long time. So that was a big part of their diet, but there's another thing that was even more important than the chemist's root.
Wapato.
A wapato is it's another name for the potato, and actually potatoes were part of their diet when the first, you know, traders and missionaries came in and started introducing them to our crops. But when they were still doing a kind of a foraging life, they didn't eat very many potatoes. Instead, there was a certain meat item, a certain fish item.
Did they have salmon also?
The salmon, because the rivers, all the rivers, everything except Lake Chelan. We'll find out why Lake Chelan didn't have any salmon in it later. But had a great potential for keeping you alive in the fall when the salmon started coming up the Columbia River and all its tributaries. Why they would build, they weren't really traps, they were kind of like areas where the fish would get concentrated. They'd slow them down enough so that they could get into a good position and spear them as they went by. And they would smoke these salmon and keep them for winter use and, of course, eat as many as they could at the time. And that was a very important part of their diet, the salmon. Kept them going through the long winter. What about their clothing? What did those people wear over in this side of the mountains? It wasn't cedar bark. Buckskins, yes. They get the deer skins, and in summertime they, of course, wore just plain buckskin. In the wintertime they left the fur on to keep it warmer. And how about their housing? What kind of homes? You could see some teepees in later years, and again, this was the result of the horse and buffalo hunting. But in the old days, there were no buffalo, and therefore there were no teepees, because there wasn't a hide big enough to build a teepee with. Instead, they had two different types of structures, a winter home and a summer home. In wintertime, they dug what they called a pit house, which is a long trench, anywhere from 3 to 5 or 6 feet deep. And then they would cover the upper part of it with a wooden framework, and they put some special mats made out of reeds. I don't know if you've ever seen rushes that grow along the rivers and the marshes, practically everywhere. These are called bulrushes. And they wove them in mats just much like we would weave a rustic little placemat out of straw or something like that. But these were large mats. They were rolled up and they could carry them on their backs or maybe make what they call a travoy, which is kind of a device for dragging heavy loads a long distance. And they would carry these mats with them. When they got to their next camp, they would build another wooden framework out of saplings and put up their next little house. It would be either cone-shaped like a teepee, or it could be shaped kind of like a quonset, kind of long. But in the wintertime, they would take these reed mats and put them above the pit. So they had like a pit down below and then a upper covering of reed mats. And there'd be a little slit in the top to let the smoke out. They had a lot of fires burning inside. Usually several families would live in one pit house. So that was their winter dwelling and their summer dwellings and their food and their clothing, just a little slice of their life. Let's see, where shall I begin? Well, let's start with Coyote. Coyote was a very important figure in the stories. And Coyote's a little bit like the angel in our Christian, in the Bible, our Christian way. He was like an intermediary between humans and God. And so when humans were having a rough time and needed help, they might ask Coyote for help. But unlike our Christian myths, Coyote was a little more human. He sometimes was greedy, sometimes he was tricky. He liked to laugh and have a good time, and he had some vices too. He wasn't perfect, as we'll learn in the stories. The first story I'd like to tell is about how Coyote brought the fire to the people. And for this, I'm going to need some help. I'll let you know when I need the help. We're at one volunteer here. And in the old days, the people were kind of helpless, just like we would be if we were put out in the wilderness with nothing to survive with. They had very little in the old days. They didn't even have fire. And this is the time of what they call the animal people. In the old myths, the people and the animals could speak the same language, and sometimes they could change themselves from one form into the other at will. And, of course, Walt Disney happened upon this idea later, but the Indians, I think, originated that, and maybe Walt Disney stole it from the Indians. But this is the way the story goes. In the old days, the people had no fire. They were miserable. In the wintertime, they froze all winter long in their lodges. They had nothing to light their lodges to keep the winter darkness away, and nothing to cook their salmon with. They were very miserable. And so they asked Coyote to come and help. Coyote came down from where he was and said, "Yes, brothers, what can I do to help?" He said, "Coyote, help us! We have no fire. Our lodges are cold and dark, and we have nothing to cook our salmon with." Now they all knew that there was only one place in all the world where there was any fire, and that was on top of the world's highest mountain. And there on top of that mountain, there was three old skookums that were kind of like witches. And they guarded that fire day and night. They wouldn't let anybody have any of it at all. And if anyone should come near that fire, they would reach out and grab them, and their touch was very dangerous. They could burn you like fire. And they would kill you very quickly. Well, Coyote was aware of all this, so he said, I will go up and see what I can do. And so he climbed up that mountain. It wasn't easy to do. It was a real high mountain. You probably know which one that was, don't you? He got to the very top, and sure enough, there was those three skookums up there guarding that fire. They took their turns one at a time. One would guard in the daytime, the other at twilight until the wee hours, and finally the last one would get up just before the sun rose and take her turn. And Coyote noticed something, that when that last skookum was watching the fire and it was getting very cold and dark, she would get up from the fire and she'd be all stiff and sore and cold and shivering, and she'd go in a little bit early. She'd go into the lodge and she'd call out, "Sister, sister, it's time to get up and call the fire!" And the other one's like, "Baby, I'm out of sleep." Coyote said, "Ah, that's my chance. I can run in and steal a burning ember from that fire and run down the mountain." But then he remembered something, that the three skookums were very fast. They would catch him, and they would touch him with their hot claws and burn him to death. That wouldn't work. So he tried to think of another way, and he thought, but he couldn't think of another way. Until finally, hillbilly form of huckleberries. Well, these three sisters were very wise. They could tell him what to do. And so he asked them, but they just said this. They said, if we told you, you would just say that you knew it all along. I remember something else, that his three sisters who lived in his belly in the form of huckleberries did not like hail. And so we'll just pretend the sky is here. He just looked up and he started to use his magic and he said, hail, hail. And they heard this and they were very afraid. They said, no, no, don't do that. Anything but that. We'll tell you what you must do. And this is what they proposed as a plan. That the coyote was to get the help of all the animal people. And so we'll need some animal people to help now. We're going to need a cougar. And we already have a volunteer. Thank you. Going to be a cougar. And then we're going to need a fox. Who's going to be our fox tonight? Smart one. And then we're going to need a squirrel. Who can climb trees and run along branches real good? Someone's being pointed out. Aha, a squirrel. And then we're going to need someone who can run real fast. This is a good runner here. The person's going to be the antelope. It's going to be the antelope. Come on, must be an antelope here someplace. Oh, good, antelope. And then we need somebody to hop real good. That person's going to be a frog. You can hop real good. Okay. And this is the plan. These animals are all going to wait in their hiding places along the mountain. They're going to run the fastest relay race that's ever been run up until this time. And Coyote was going to start the race. He climbed back up to the top of the mountain again. And he waited until that sister was getting real cold and tired. And wanted to go in the lodge and get warm and sleep. So she got up the fire, kind of stumbled along and said, sister, sister, it's time to get up and go in the barn. And the other one said, leave me alone, I don't want to sleep. So Coyote ran over the fire and he grabbed a burning ember from the fire real quick, like, and he started running down the mountain as fast as he could. But in instants, the three scuffles were after him. They reached out and they tried to catch him. One of them managed to touch just the tip of his tail, just the very tip. And left it all black. And to this day, coyotes still have a black tip on the end of their tail. Well, he was having a rough time, but he was running for his life. He was jumping over the ice and the snow, and finally he got down to a place where there was a few bushes amongst the rocks and the snow as he got a little lower down the mountain, and there he saw the cougar waiting, and he gave the stick to the cougar, and the cougar started running. Hurry, cougar! Running down that mountain, and the scuffles were after him. The scuffles were after him. But he just barely stayed ahead of him. And then he saw in some little higher bushes, the fox was waiting. And he gave the fire to the fox, and the fox started running down the mountain. He just barely had the scuffles. Then she got to the place where it was a little lower, so there were some trees. And there she saw the squirrel waiting. Gave the fire to the squirrel. Now, well, that's a great squirrel. The fire was still so hot. And when that squirrel was holding the fire, it started to curl up her tail. And to this day, the squirrel still has a big curl in her tail. Well, the scuffles were going to grab that squirrel when she got to the last tree. But right under the last tree, the antelope was waiting to get that fire. And she started running. Whoa, was she fast. Which is good, because the next runner wasn't quite as fast. This was a frog. And she gave the fire to the frog. And the frog was hopping as fast as she could, but so the younger scuffle, the fastest one, grabbed a hold of that frog by the tail and held on. And what did the frog do? She jumped as hard as she could and left her tail behind. No tail. Well,
story over.
Then the frog dove into the river, swam across the river, and came up on the other side. But that young skookum was a good jumper. She jumped right across that river and was just about ready to grab the frog. When what did she do? She just tossed the fire right into a piece of wood. It was a log laying there. She just tossed it right in there, and it just kind of went right into the wood. Right into the wood. Just kind of like disappeared in that piece of wood. And that's where it's been ever since. While the skookums came down, thank you, frog. The skookums came down, and found that piece of wood. And they could tell it was some fire inside of it, but they couldn't figure out how to get it out. It was just like an ordinary piece of wood. It wasn't burning, but they knew there was fire inside of there now. And they tried to figure out how to get the fire out, and they thought and they thought, and they walked around it and looked at it, and finally they just gave up and walked away. And then the coyote and all the animal people came down, and they too came to the fire. The animal said to Coyote, "Coyote, how do we get the fire out of the wood?" And what do you suppose he did? Well, first he had to get a little hotter. How did he get it hot?
Bark.
He had to rub some things together. Now, in the old days, they just rubbed a couple of sticks together, and you had to be really fast to make something hot enough that way. You can imagine to rub a couple of sticks together. But later, they got more high tech, the Indians did. Instead of just doing this, they twirled the wood. They used what's called a bow drill. They had one stick kind of balanced on the other. And then they had a bow with a bowstring wrapped around this thing, and they'd run it back and forth and go real fast. And before long, there's another ranger I knew that actually did this as a demonstration. I won't try to do it. He could get a fire going that way. He could get smoking and then glowing, and then finally take a little bit of tinder and put it in there and start it flaming up. So that's how they got the fire going. So since that time, the people have had fire. And of course, we've had fire too, in a lot of different forms. What are some of the different forms that we've had our fire in?
Lightning.
Lightning, yes. A good old electric fire.
Volcanoes,
yes. But of course, the lightning and the volcanoes aren't something that we can really just put in our pocket and take home to heat our lodge, are they? But we found other ways of heating our lodges.
Matches.
Well, yes, we found matches, but what do we burn with the matches? Wood. What do we use for fuel? We have wood and
coal.
And today we have things like coal and
oil.
Gasoline. All kinds of stuff. Even atoms. Even water. How do we get fire out of water?
By putting lots of water on it.
Lots of water, and what do we run it through to get the fire out of it? Run it through a hydroelectric plant, and then we can get fire out of, you know, a different kind of fire, but it's energy. So this story probably had a little bit different meaning from what it might have to us today. Just think about that. You know, the Indians didn't have an energy crisis, but we do, don't we? At least we're told we do. I'm thinking maybe those skookums are still waiting around to get that fire back. Well, I'd like to jump from here to the coast. We go out to the coast and to a place called Crooked Beach in the old days. Oh, thank you, animals. Yes. There's something else I didn't say. Is that another thing that I think of when I tell this story is how important everything is to everything else. And by telling this story, we show how important all living things are to every other living thing. It was teamwork that was needed to accomplish this very vital task of getting the fire. And so this story kind of reminds us that all other living things are very important to us. We can't ignore them, we can't forget them. This next story takes place on the coast at a place called Crooked Beach. And this story was told by the Kwakiutl people. I'm probably not pronouncing that exactly.
Kwakiutl.
Kwakiutl. Okay, good. Well, I was close anyway. Thank you. And they lived along the coast of what's now British Columbia, but of course there wasn't any U.S. or Canada back in those days. And they lived, like we told you before, in these cedar lodges. They ate a lot of seafood, lots of great clams and salmon and halibut and salmon and clams day after day after day. Can you imagine what that would be like? They got very bored with all that great seafood. They wanted something different. And they wanted some good red meat. And of all the different kinds of good red meat, the one they liked the best was the sweet and tender meat of the mountain goat, someone suggested before. And they had to go to great effort to get the mountain goat, because here they were down on the beach, and the mountain goats were way up in the mountains. The mountain goats never came down to the beach. So they had to really work hard to get up there. And that was all it took for a while, but then something else happened. A monster came in the mountains. He was cannibal from the north edge of the world. He was very fierce. He loved to eat. He would eat just about anything. Mountain goats, sure, but humans, even better. Some of them happened to come up there. Now, I guess he didn't come down on the mountains very much. You didn't have to worry as long as you didn't go up in the mountains. But the hunters that went up to hunt the goats, they just kept on disappearing until finally people just didn't dare go up there anymore. Now, amongst the people at Crooked Beach, there was three young men whose father had been one of the last to go up and, of course, who never came back. And they were really thinking about avenging his death. They were just of that age when they had just become men a short time ago. They were very brave. Actually, the youngest was the bravest. The middle brother was kind of could go either way. The oldest brother was sort of a wimp, but maybe a little bit smarter in some ways. Anyway, they practiced their archery skills and got to be very good at the bow and the arrow. They had very good bows made of the yew wood, which is what they used for bows in those days. And they could shoot just about anything with those arrows. They were pretty confident. But one thing they didn't know, they'd never been taken to the mountains. They didn't know how to get there. They thought and thought and tried to figure out how to get there. And finally they remembered that they did have a supernatural friend. Instead of coyote here, they had black bird who was
Raven.
They said, Raven! Raven came down in the sky and he said, yes, brothers. They said, Raven, help us. We want to get into the mountains, but we don't know the way. We want to hunt the mountain goat. Raven looked at him and he said, brothers, he said, haven't you heard of cannibal from the north edge of the world? You should go up to hunt the mountain goat. Cannibal will hunt you and he will eat you. Well, older brother said, looked at the other two and he said, maybe, brothers, we should forget about this hunting and just live a little longer. But younger brother replied, he said, Raven, he said, we're not afraid of cannibal. If he should come after us, we will shoot him through the heart. To which Raven replied, he said, brothers, he said, don't you know that cannibal has no heart? He was drowned in a whirlpool many years ago, but came out alive. And if you should go after him with your little bows and arrows, he would just pick them out like they were little birds. Wouldn't bother him at all. Well, again, older brother said, brothers, maybe we should listen to Raven and forget about this hunting deal. But after Raven had left, a younger brother went to his two older brothers and he said, brothers, he said, I think you should go and live with the women, he said. I think you should put on skirts, take care of the children, and start skinning the fish. Well, this shamed the two older brothers, and they agreed to go hunting. And so they got all their gear together, their best bows, a lot of arrows, their best moccasins, plenty of spares, and some dried food, and they set off towards the mountains. But it wasn't easy. They traveled for many days, and they started going around in circles. Finally, they looked at each other and agreed that they were lost. But then they looked around the corner of this creek. Instead of roads and trails, the only way to get anywhere was follow a creek. And they saw a strange thing. Around the corner, there was this little lodge. But they could see inside a very strange, sort of supernatural creature. The top of her was a woman, her head and her shoulders and down to about her waist, but the rest of her was a tree trunk rooted into the ground, and she was weeping and weeping and weeping. They said, sister, sister, why do you weep? She said, I'm weeping for you because you're gonna die. If you go on any further, you're gonna die, she said. And she kept on weeping. And they said, sister, sister, don't worry about us. We're just going hunting for the mountain goat. And she said, brothers, you must go no further or you will die, you will die. And finally she talked him into kind of spending a little time with her, and she invited him into her lodge, and they rested for a little bit. They got some soup to eat and spent the night. And then she told him a little more. She said, brother, she said, if you should go up to the mountain goat country, there you will meet cannibal from the north edge of the world. And if he should find you, he will catch you and eat you alive, she said. You won't have a chance. So they thought about that for a while, but again, younger brother got the others stirred up and shamed them into continuing the quest. Finally, she could see that they just wouldn't be dissuaded, so she said, I'm going to give you some help. She says, I'm going to give you some magic charms. So she gave him three things. I got all three things here. There were 10, and you've been missing the ones right here. She gave him a grindstone. Let's see if there's one in here. Something like a stone. Ah, yes. A grindstone. And she gave him a cone that was made of yew wood. I don't seem to feel that in there, but we'll pretend there's one in here. And she also gave him a flask that was filled with oil. These were their magic charms, and she said to them, Brother, she said, if Cannibal should find you, as surely he will if you go up to Cannibal's country, you must run for your lives as fast as you can. And just before he catches up with you, you can throw these things on the ground one by one, and that will slow him down. So they brought these charms with her, and they continued on their journey. She showed them how to get up onto the mountain, they got up through the forest. They got up to a place where there was just little shrubs along the way. And finally they got even higher to where there was nothing but bare rocks, and then snow and ice. And they got up to a high ridge where they could kind of look out and see a ways off into the distance. And there was a lodge, and they remembered the words, and the woman moved to the ground. She said, if you should come to the lodge of the mountain goat, you will see white smoke rising out of the smoke hole. The smoke will be as white as fog. But, she said, if you should come to Cannibal's lodge, you will see coming out of the smoke hole, smoke as red as blood. And sure enough, we off in the distance, they could see that smoke coming up. It was smoke that was red as blood. And eldest brother said, Brothers, he said, we've gone this far, but we still have our lives. Let's leave now while we're still here to tell about this. And youngest brother replied, he said, Brothers, he said, you can return, but I will go on alone. And the shameful again, so they agreed to go on with him. They walked up to the lodge, and a very strange woman came out. On the top, she was like a bird. She had a long beak like an albatross, type of seabird. And she spoke in high, squeaky notes. She said,
Hey, brothers, welcome, come into my lodge.
And so they did. They went into the lodge and sat down by her fire and kind of rested there for a few minutes. She was cooking something for them. But before she got done, they heard a little rustling sound in the dark corner. Something was coming out of the darkness. It was just like the woman, except it was much smaller. It was crawling along because it was just a little baby. It had the bird's head, no long beak, just like its mother. And it spoke in these little squeaky sounds. It was saying, and then it pointed at the three young men like that and said, Meat! Well, the brothers were terrified. They jumped up and they ran out of the lodge as fast as they could, but it wasn't much use because as soon as they did, that woman jumped up behind them and she called out,
Cannibal, come quick! Meat has come to our lodge, but Meat is running away!
And just as soon as she said those words, she could hear a thumping in the distance. And she heard this, they heard this big giant calling out,
Me!
Well, that got him mighty scared. Gave him a little rush to start running. But it didn't take long before that great big giant was almost up with him. His body was so tall you could see his head over the tops of the trees. And he had great big long hair with a kind of a ponytail in the back, and it was kind of bobbing along. You could see that thing too, bobbing along behind him. And just before that giant caught up with him, Cannibal, as he was called, finally, older brother remembered that grindstone, and he dropped him on the ground behind him. Became a huge stone cliff that separated him from Cannibal. Well, that didn't stop him. It just slowed him down a little bit, and it gave him a little head start. They could hear him calling out, climbing up that cliff. He was still hungry, so he kept on saying,
Hop, 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 meat!
Well, it wasn't long before he was over the cliff. And they were on the run again. And almost out of breath. And then middle brother remembered the coal made of yew wood. And this is where the storyteller is going to use his magic. He dropped the yew wood comb on the ground, and it became a vast tangle of yew bushes. I don't know if any folks have been in some yew thickets. They're found all over the mountains, even on this side of the mountains. And there certainly were some where the three brothers were trying to escape.
And they slowed that cannibal down. He got into that thicket of bushes and he started ripping and tearing at him, kicking at him and trying to get through him and slowed him down a bit. But after that, he was at him again. And then younger brother remembered the third charm. Actually, there's one more charm we'll find out about later. But he poured that flask of oil on the ground and it became a huge lake separating them from cannibal. Well, this slowed him down because now he had to run all the way around that great big lake to get to them. And so they were able to get a little head start again, and they got just to the edge of the ridge where they could look down and see their village far below. They could see Crooked Beach far below there. They could even see the little huts along the beach. And then they remember they had a helper, and they call out, "Raven, Raven, help us!" Raven came down in the sky, and he said, "Yes, brothers." He said, "Raven, Raven, help us. Cannibal is almost..." And they told him the whole story. Raven thought about this a minute, and he said, "Brothers," he said, "I have a plan." And he said, "This is what you must do." He said, "You must run as fast as you could, as fast as you can, down the beach. And there you will find my magician's hut." He had a hut down the beach where he made his magic. "And there you must join me, and I'll tell you what to do." Raven flew off down the beach. When he got down there, he built a great big bonfire. And he got some forked sticks and he piled a great big pile of big rocks in that bonfire until the rocks were glowing hot and red. And then he went back to his hut. It was probably about the size of his room, maybe a little bigger. And he dug a great big pit in the middle of the room. He must have been a pretty good digger. So he dug that out big enough to fit in a cannibal. And when he was all done, he very cleverly covered up the top of this pit with small, little, flimsy sticks, just like a tiger trap. And then he covered that over with reed mats, so it looked like an ordinary room no one would ever suspect. Just as he got that job done, he heard the three brothers running down the hill. Now, the cannibal had almost caught him in the meantime, but they had one last charm that didn't tell you about before. The woman said to him, the woman rooted the ground, "If cannibal catches up you after all this, just throw all those arrows of yours on the ground and break them up. Drop them on the ground, and that will slow them down." It sure did. They turn into a forest ripped by the wind. Well, if you ever gotten on the trails around Holden before the trail crew has been up here, clear that you'd know what a trail ripped by the, or a forest ripped by the wind is like. It's just like a tangle, like an incredible maze of broken trees at every imaginable angle. You just can't go anywhere. So cannibal was out there, and he was going to lift up some of these trees, he was crawling underneath some of them, and jumping over other ones, and it took him a few hours. And it gave those brothers just time to get down to the beach. So they ran down, all out of breath, and scared, really scared. And they saw, "Oh, Raven, help us," they said. "Cannibal's just behind us." Raven said, "Brothers," he said, "listen very carefully. This is what they had to do." He said, "Brothers, I want you to walk into the hut, but I want you to walk in very carefully, right along the edge of the hut, and do not ever go into the middle of the hut." And so they walked along the edge of the hut until he got just about opposite where the entrance was. And they waited there, sitting down in the shadows. And just about when that had happened, they heard Cannibal thumping down the mountain. He was going out, "Me!" To the hut. He saw Raven. He said, "Raven," he said, "where's my meat?" Raven looked up and he said, "Ah, Cannibal," he said, "it's so good to see you. We're having a great feast. And I sent those three brothers up to invite you to the feast, and they're waiting for you inside." And this Cannibal lunged into the hut and he fell into that great pit full of hot rocks. He died an awful death. I don't know what he sounded like. Something like this. After a while, there was nothing left of Cannibal but a little pile of ashes bottom of that pit. A couple of days went by, they let the ashes cool down a little bit, and Raven decided it was time to clean things up, do some house cleaning. And so he brought the three brothers back, and he said, "Brothers," he says, "I want you to help me clean up this place. Get these ashes out of here and fill up this pit, and we're going to make this back into a magic house." So they took some scoops, and they got down where those ashes are, and they started to scoop them up. But they started to make little sounds. The ashes started to say, into the wind. And this is what those ashes said then. As soon as they got in the wind, they said, they said, we will eat the flesh and drink the blood of all mankind forever. And they became all the mosquitoes, all the flies, all the horse flies, all the gnats, all the little sinners, and all those little things that eat your flesh and suck your blood. So now you know what was biting you today. And even after all these years, cannibal still loves us. Kind of change its meanings. It probably means something different to us than what it meant to those people back in those days. They saw this as a great opportunity. Here were all these little things flying around. They were kind of like, had this spirit of cannibalism. They were sort of like a shining example. And so in the past, the young warriors, when they were trying to learn how to become a real warrior, would look upon these little flying things as a source of inspiration. That's where they get their fierceness from these little, can you imagine being as fierce as a mosquito? Hardly anything fiercer than that, is there? They would have ceremonies, and it would go something like this. It was like a little play act. These young men who had just been inducted into manhood would be restrained. They were so fierce that they weren't safe to be amongst people. And so they'd kind of tie them down. They'd have ropes around them. But always one of them would manage to get loose. And he'd go running through the crowd, biting people. And of course, if you got bitten, then the host would give you a lot of presents to pay for that. But it was kind of like a big party. Initiation in manhood. But we can see a lot of other things in this story, in addition to the reason why those things are flying around and eating us. Think about that. There's some kind of meanings to this. Maybe there's another cannibal out there someplace. What have we done to him? Well, I'll let you think about that. Meanwhile, I'd like to tell another story that comes from the coyote stories. There's many, many of these coyote stories known to tribes all over the West. And this one comes from the Okanagan people. The one I told you earlier is kind of like a general story known by many tribes all over the eastern part of the mountains. But this one is fairly particular to the Okanagan people. However, different versions of it exist in many tribes all over Washington and Oregon. This is about how coyote brought the salmon up the Columbia River. And they had a different name for the Okanagan call it, the Shwanetqua, which is the Columbia River. And I'll introduce a couple of other Okanagan words going along. And this was, as we said, very important. You gotta have that salmon or else you won't have anything to eat. And the people didn't have any salmon. Because what had happened? Some certain monsters had built a great big dam down near the mouth of the King River, down near the mouth of the Shwanetqua, and the salmon could no longer get up the river. The people were getting hungrier and hungrier and hungrier. Finally, they had to ask Coyote for help. Coyote came along and he said, brothers, he said, what can I do to help? And they said, Coyote, we want you to go down and break that dam so the salmon can get back up the river so we can have salmon. We're so hungry that we're eating tree bark and mud, and our children have no food, and they're starving. So Coyote walked down the river for many days, because it's many days from the Okanagan country, which is north and east of us here, down to where the Columbia runs into the big water, the ocean. But that big dam was guarded by the two Snipe sisters. Now, does anyone know what a snipe is? Heard about snipe hunts? Well, these were real snipe. They really do exist. There was a big snipe and a little snipe. They're all sisters. And they were guarding that dam. If anyone came close, they would fly off where the monsters were. And those monsters would come out and they'd take care of whoever it was real quick. But Coyote was pretty smart. And so he kind of snuck up on that dam. He looked around, and he could see those two snipe sisters. So he used his magic to change himself into another form. He made himself into a beautiful cooking basket.
And those Snipe sisters had a little bit of vanity. They, especially the younger one, they like to collect things. And this is a very pretty cooking basket. It was so tightly woven, just like people did in those days, that you could fill it with water and the water would stay in it. And of course, they'd take hot rocks and cook their food in it. And it was very nicely decorated. Beautiful little cooking basket. In their language, they called it a lachin. So Coyote became a lachin, and he started floating down the river. And the Snipe sister saw it, and the big snipe was kind of suspicious. So she just let it float by. The little snipe just loved it. She said, "Oh, sister, sister," she said, "look at that beautiful basket. I must have it. I must have it." And big snipe said to little snipe, she said, "There's something strange about that basket," she said. "You better stay away from it." But little snipe started pleading and begging and begging and pleading. She said, "Oh, please, I want to have that basket. Oh, it's so beautiful. I must. And this went on. Finally, the big snipe said, "Oh, go and get that basket." So she swam out of the river and grabbed that basket and brought it back. And she was so happy and so proud. She put all her food in it. Of course, they always went fishing for the salmon down below the dam, of course, and had more than enough salmon to eat. And so little snipe would bring out that basket full of salmon. They'd bring it up to their lodge at night, and they'd have a nice salmon dinner. And of course, there was more salmon than she could eat, so she'd just eat a little bit of it and leave the rest of the basket. But as soon as she turned her back, all that salmon was gone. You know, wait, don't you? Coyote has a big appetite. Well, this got him kind of suspicious. This went on for a couple of weeks, and Big Snipe thought it was Little Snipe who was eating up all this stuff. And so she said, "Oh, sister," she said, you're such a pig, you're such a glutton. What's gotten into you anyway?" And finally, Little Snipe said, "Well, it's me that ate all that fish." So Big Snipe got real suspicious, took the basket, and threw it towards the fire. As soon as it hit the flames of the fire, it bounced back out and became a baby boy! A real cute baby boy. Little Snipe saw that little baby boy. She said, "Oh, a beautiful baby boy! I want to make him into our little brother! Won't that be nice?" Big Snipe said, "There's something very wrong about that little baby. Don't touch it! Don't touch it," she said. But Little Snipe begged and pleaded. She said, "Oh, sister, it's so beautiful. I just must have this, and you'll love it too." And sure enough, as soon as they decided they would keep the baby boy, it was just so cute and so beautiful. They both loved it a lot. It had lots of neat tricks it could do. It just became their pride of their life. And every morning they would go down to the dam to catch some more salmon. And they were very careful with little brother. They tied his ankle to the lodge pole so he wouldn't get off and get drowned in the river. They didn't want him to get hurt. So they'd run off and leave him there. As soon as they left, and the baby would turn himself back into Coyote. And he'd run down to the dam, and he'd start digging as fast as he could into the dam, trying to make a hole in it. And he was making pretty good headway. Every day he'd dig it a little bit deeper, a little bit wider, a little bit further in. And after a couple of weeks, he was almost done. Every day, of course, when he got back, he knew about what time they'd be done with their fishing. He raced back up to the lodge and changed himself back into a baby boy. And they didn't suspect anything until the very last day. Coyote went down, dug until he was almost done breaching that dam. Almost dug his way all the way through, he said to himself, "Well, one more day and that'll be it." So he went back up and changed himself into a baby. The next morning, he took a wooden spoon before he left the lodge and put it on top of his head. Now this is going to be some kind of magic, I guess. And he went down and he started digging out those last few rocks out of the dam and starting to breach it. But it was a bigger job than he thought. And he thought it would just take a couple hours, but it actually took him all day and he wasn't even done. The Snipe sisters were done with their fishing and went back up to the lodge. And the little baby boy was gone! And the little snipe was so sad. "No! Oh, oh no, he's gone! Where did he go? What are you gonna do?" And finally she stopped crying long enough, and the big snipe said, "Why don't we go and look for him? Maybe we can follow his tracks." And so they followed the little baby's tracks, and as soon as they got outside of the lodge, they saw they turned into coyote tracks. And then they started running as fast as they could down the dam, but it was too late because Coyote had dug away the dam, and the water was starting to flow through, and they got so excited they just took a stick and they started beating Coyote over the head
but it didn't do any good because he had the wooden spoon on top of his head. It must have had some kind of magic, kind of kept those blows away from his head. And they were so excited they forgot to call the monsters. Before they could do anything, the water had breached the dam, and it was rushing through, and the dam just started to wash away piece by piece. And, well, I don't know what happened to those snipes. We don't hear about any more about them in the story. But then Coyote started bringing the salmon up the river. There were thousands of them there waiting to come up the river. They'd been waiting for a long time. And they followed Coyote up the river in a herd. And they waited for him when he stopped, and when he continued, they followed him further. They kept on going up the river until they got to some of the streams that ran into the Columbia River, the Swanette, as they call it. The first one they got to was the Yakima River. Anybody here come from around Yakima? Nobody? Well, the Yakima River, at first, of course, didn't have any salmon, but when Coyote arrived, he went up the river ways and he found the Yakima people. And he started cutting a little deal with them. He said, hey, look what I've got here. And he showed them the salmon, and he was kind of interested. And then he looked at some of the Yakima ladies, and he was kind of interested in them. So they made a deal. They cut a deal that Coyote married one of the Yakima girls, and in return, they got to keep some of the salmon. So every year after that, the salmon kept on coming back up the river. Every fall, they go up the river and lay some eggs. That's the new salmon going. They would grow up, come down the river. Actually, they didn't grow up all the way. They started down as little salmon, went down to the big water of the ocean, and then after they grew up, they come back up the river. That went on year after year until, of course, I guess something else changed that later. We won't talk about that right now. But then Coyote got kind of bored with his Yakima wife and decided it was time for more adventure, for him to go north. So he went back to the main fork of the river, and there his salmon were still waiting for him, and he went up a little further until he got to another river. I'm sure it was that he spoke. It was the Wenatchee River. And there he saw a lot of people along the river, and they really liked those salmon. And he found two girls that he really liked, and he married both of them. And, well, as you probably know, the salmon been coming up the Wenatchee River a long time until very recently, but we won't talk about that right now. And, never wanted for a lot of salmon. Matter of fact, they had so many salmon they shared with other tribes. People came from all over the Northwest to the Wenatchee River to hunt for, to actually spear salmon in the fall. But then Coyote got kind of bored with the Wenatchee wives and decided to go a little further until he got to another river. Which river was that? That was the Chelan River, yes. And there he met the Chelan people. And they had some real pretty looking girls too, and he thought he'd like to marry a couple of those. But when he talked to the chief just said, Coyote, he said, we don't want these old, beat up, rotten salmon, he said. When we want some meat, we go up to get bone goats. He was kind of angered, Coyote, and he said, well, he said, you will get none of these salmon. In fact, he said, you're going to walk many miles along the river to get some rotten, beat-up salmon, and you'll be real happy that you get them, but you won't get any of them here. And so he built a great big dam, and to this day, no salmon go off the Columbia River into Lake Chelan, because if you go down to Chelan Falls, you can see a very big waterfall there. And of course, in the springtime, when the water's coming over the man-made dam that was put up there, you can see the water coming down. No salmon would ever be able to get up that waterfall. And so to this day, until, of course, we folks change things, there's been no salmon at Lake Chelan. But, of course, we have changed things. And originally, of course, the salmon were kind of a yearly banquet. It depended on just like clockwork. Some of the salmon would not get trapped, would not get speared by the people, and they would go up to these little streams and they would lay their eggs. And then, of course, the little salmon would catch out. They'd walk a little bit in those streams, and they'd start working their way down the little streams until they got to the Swanetqua, from the river. And they go down the Swanetqua until they got to the sea, and they go out into the ocean. And some of them go thousands of miles, going with a great big salmon. And then somehow they always remembered where they came from. They always returned. And the Indians knew that, and they took advantage of it. But they never took more salmon than what they needed for themselves. And they shared them with other tribes. Kind of had some kind of a system. I'm not sure exactly what it was, that
on this Sunday, why so-and-so would fish, and on that Saturday, so-and-so would fish, and everybody got enough to eat. But later on, things changed, didn't they? What were we trying to get out of the Shawnee Corps when we came? We of course, fish for the salmon when the salmon were there, but then we wanted to fish. We wanted some fire, yes.
Fire.
We wanted fire, and so we started building dams. And at first thought, we thought that we could keep the salmon by doing various little tricks. Maybe we thought maybe we could put in some hatcheries and raise a few salmon and dump them into the river, and that would solve the problem. But we somehow managed to figure out how to get the salmon up the river, but they never came back down, because these fish ladders that we built were okay for the salmon to go up, but the little salmon that hatched up in the little streams couldn't get back down. And so I'm afraid that things have really gone downhill. Those salmon that once fed millions of people are practically all gone today. So I guess Coyote could have told us that. When you build a dam, the salmon don't go up past the dam. So if you want salmon, don't build dams in your river. I have another story that comes from the people who live almost down at the mouth of the Columbia River. These are people that probably knew about Coyote and how he broke down that big dam. But this story takes place after the dam was broken down, and the salmon were there for the people to eat. This comes from the Chinook people. Does anyone know where the Chinook people lived originally in the old times? The lower part of the Columbia River. And the story takes place in the winter time. It was a winter very much like the one we've just had. The snow came down every day and built up deeper and deeper, and the cold never stopped. And when the time came for spring to come, instead of spring, there was more snow. Every night, the snow got deeper and deeper. It was up to a man's belly. It was up to a man's chest. And the river was filled with blocks of ice that came crashing down all day and all night. Their camp, of course, was right along the river, so they heard all this noise. And all around them, there was nothing that was alive that could be seen except for some little white birds that flew about in the snow. They called them snowbirds. Because the only bird was alive. They were wondering, when is spring going to come? When is winter going to end? They were mighty tired that winter. And then one day, they saw this little bird flying over. It had something red in its beak. And then everybody started shouting and pointing at the bird. The bird must have gotten scared because it opened its beak and it dropped that red thing on the snow. And guess what it was? It was a ripe strawberry. And then they knew that something was very wrong, because summer had come not far away, but here it was still winter. Something was very wrong. What had gone wrong? Well, they decided they'd have to have a big meeting, a big council. And they gathered all the oldest and wisest people, and they started talking this thing over. They talked for many hours through the night. At first, they didn't have any answer. Then, at one point, the oldest man got up, and this is what he said.
In the old days, they said that if someone should stone a bird, that winter would never end.
And then they knew what had happened. Probably one of the children had thrown a stone at a bird. And winter was angry, and he wouldn't let spring come. And so then they had to have another meeting. They talked all the rest of the night what they were going to do. And they started questioning all the people in the tribe. Finally, the children started pointing this little girl, and they said it was she that did it. Her mother and father were very afraid because she was an only child. Well, they talked about this for many more hours, what they were to do. And then the head man, the chief, came up to the parents and he said, at first we thought that we would have to kill your daughter so that winter would be satisfied and let the spring come. But then we thought of a better plan, he said. We will not kill your daughter. We're going to give her to winter. And so they had a great feast. And everyone was invited. They got out all their best food. Everyone put on their best clothes. And the little girl was dressed even better than everybody else. And they gave many gifts to the little girl's parents. But that did not soften their hearts. And then when all the feasting was over, some young men went down the river
and they got a long pole, and they brought in this great big block of ice from the river. And then they put straw and reed mats on top of the ice. And they took the little girl, and she was wailing and crying away. Crying was so loud that it even drowned out the sound of the crashing ice. They put her on that ice block, and they shoved it off into the raging river. And for a while, all you could hear was the little girl's cries and the cries of the mother and the father. And then everybody went back up to the village, and they started singing a song to try to forget about it. And after a while, they did forget about it, because in a few hours, a warm wind came. And then, in just 2 days, all that snow melted away, and the green grass and the flowers started to come up. And then they knew that old man was right. So sometimes you have to do something that, although it seems very, very hard, maybe for your benefit in the long run. And so, this is what they thought. And with summer, of course, they went back to their usual activities. The women went up in the hills to dig the caddis roots, and the men started hunting the deer. And then later on, they started to pick berries and dry them for the winter. And then finally, fall came, and they started trapping the salmon. They started building traps, that is, and spearing the salmon, and the women started to smoke them and get them ready for winter. And then winter came again, just like it did before. The snow got deeper and deeper, and the ice started to come down the river. And one day, some young men were standing by the river, and they looked way off. And they said, "Oh, look," they said, "there's something caught in that eddy." Now, eddy is a whirlpool where things just don't go in a straight line in the water. They just go around and around in a circle. And they never seem to get out of that whirlpool. That's what happened to this piece of ice. But there was something on top of the block of ice. And they sent a couple runners off to get a closer look, and they said, it's a human, it's a body laying on that block of ice. And so somehow they managed to get some long, long poles, and they were able to get a hold of that block of ice and drag it into shore. And it was the same little girl that had gone off the winter before. And she wasn't moving now, but they took her up and wrapped her in some blankets, and they brought her back to her parents' lodge, and they put her down by the fire. And in a few hours, she started to move and stir. And by the next morning, she was running around just like everybody else and seemed to be just fine. But she wasn't exactly the same as when she left, because now she had some new powers. Now she could walk around on the ice and the snow with no moccasins. She was barefoot. Didn't seem to mind the cold at all. And so they knew that some kind of magic had gotten into her. And so they decided it was time for a new name. Whenever somebody gets some new magic or new power, they give them a new name. And so they had another big feast, and they gave her a new name. What do you suppose they called her? They called her Wakani, which in their language means she drifts. So that's kind of a strange story. But does it have any meaning to us today? And I don't know who's in the stone, but that's kind of a symbolic thing. So I'd like to close with a little prayer that comes from the Plains Indians, and although it's not from the folks around here, they would probably agree with it, the sentiments contained in it. And what it means to me is that everything is interconnected, that throwing a stone at something here can have a far-reaching effect on something maybe far away, that everything is together, everything is related, just like the animals that helps coyote turns fire down the mountain. This is the way it goes. Grandfather, Great Spirit, all over the world, the faces of the living ones are alike. With tenderness, they have come up out of the ground. Look upon your children, that they may face the winds and walk the good road to the day of quiet. Grandfather, Great Spirit, fill us with the light. Give us strength to understand and the eyes to see. Teach us to walk the soft earth as relatives to all that live. Thank you. In learning more about the local Indian people, there's a real good book at our bookstore in Wapato Heritage. And it's about the fate of the Indians since the white man arrived. I haven't talked anything about this. This book
an excellent job of kind of filling in that part.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. I remember reading about some fellows that tried to travel all across North America in canoe and got swamped and died.
The Portland area is because of that. And then he lives on the coast also. And then he and his wife managed to work out a plan, so he went up to the headwaters of the Columbia River.
Did he?
And she would go periodically and take his food.
Uh-huh.
He would stop over at different places. And, I think it was pretty exciting at times.
Yes.
It's quite wonderful.
It's a long,
yes,
long journey.
I wish I could. Well, I went past the bridge over the canyon there, the river, the stream there.
Mm-hmm.
And
the bridge with the high rails?
Yes,
yeah.
Yeah. And I finally decided I better come back because it was so hot.
Yeah.
I was afraid I'd be tired and might have a few glitches here and there. So by the time I got back,
it must have been as high as the
trail. That trail is not as older than the other.
Yeah, it's
not
yet the trail.
Yeah. But I enjoyed it too because it was pretty nice because it went up and down.
Uh-huh.
I'm tempted to make another go at it and see if I can go the rest of the way.
Yeah, it's a nice hike up to the little falls there. And I think what I enjoy most is that change in the plant community.
At Nine Mile
Creek, it's
uh-huh.
just like you just sort of popping through the hole into another world.
Well, I was quite interested in that bridge.
Much impressed. Did you do seminars or something to learn to tell stories
I guess I didn't say this before. I did take a storytelling course in graduate school. But a lot of the inspiration came from other places, but the instructor there, he was a professional storyteller, so fantastic characters that I've tried to emulate, but unless it's you, it doesn't really come through.
You have such an
character
interesting Indian
Sam
Indian lore and spirituality and tales anyway. They come beautiful, natural stories. Well,
I found there's kind of like a little hobo jungle behind the building here. It seems like people just kind of head back there and hunker down.
Oh, yeah.
The ground under the trees is all trampled down. Little pieces of trash laying here and there. It's kind of like, you ever been in a kind of like an urban area where there's a little lot next to a playground? The kids just kind of run in and just, you know, just use that area so intensively that it's all just bare ground under the trees.
That's
what it seems. So I don't know who's using it.
That was so memorable as a child. finding...
finding a place
we'd
in the woods.
We'd find a cluster of trees that
yes.
went way down to the ground.
And
we'd find a hollow space underneath.
Yes.
And that'd be our... I remember that being our stopping
foot.
Place on the way home from school. The
exactly.
other kids I walked with, and we'd all crawl in under this tree.
Yes.
It was cool for one thing. It was a shady spot.
It had to be some place where grown-ups weren't allowed. And
that's
guess,
right, where grown-ups didn't even know
it
existed.
It was kind of like a debate. I guess I had a... Most of my friends were, you know, males, and so no girls allowed.
That's another thing. Well, we were all girls.
So the girls had their place, the boys had their place.
That's right. I had a very girl group that I grew up with. There were some boys kind of peripheral to the group, but not as the... We didn't really spend very much time together.